Hello, this is Deborah on Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of October. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part two of our show about reading wildlife sign with our guest expert tracker, Jill Cooper, and our guest recorder, Meg Amos. Hello to both of you. Nice to have you back.
Yeah, I'm excited to be back. We'll see what we can find today.
We are returning to our exploration of the new restoration project between Indian and Maristone Islands that we started last month. We've now come through the bridge, underneath the bridge, and we were noticing how great this is, not just for fish passage, but for the passage of other animals. I mean, we found a veritable river otter highway, right?
Yeah, it was amazing how many river otter tracks we saw, some really beautiful ones, and definitely more than one individual crossing back and forth under there. And I was just imagining what it would be like to be an otter here before that bridge was put in. And if you wanted to get to the other side of the road, you had to cross over it, or I guess maybe swim through the culvert. So this is a really amazing wildlife passage project for a lot more than just salmon.
Yes, indeed. Last month, we had just been talking about dog tracks, the difference between dog and coyote. And then as we crossed under the bridge, we noticed all of these otter tracks, and you were talking about gait and how you can tell the difference between like a lope and a gallop and a walk and a trot. Jill, do you want to review that for us, please?
Yeah, sure. So we saw this beautiful set of otter tracks doing what otters usually do, their preferred gait, which is a lope. And lopes and gallops are usually grouped together, as are walks and trots. And the reason for that is that lopes and gallops have four footprints as a group, and then a big space, and then another four as a group, and then a space, and a group, and a space. And some people say it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, pause, 1, 2, 3, 4, pause. Whereas the walks and trots are more consistent. There's just even spaces between all of the footprints. So it's more of a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And so that's how you can tell the main difference. And then if you want to go even deeper into lopes versus gallops, the difference that most people use to differentiate those is that a gallop is so fast that the animal is actually in the air twice as they push off and jump and then push off again with their hind feet and jump. And so the hinds completely pass the fronts, and the group of four will actually appear on the ground as two hind feet in front of the two front feet, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, and you can also tell the size of the animal, right, by measuring between the groups of tracks.
That works best with walks and trots because the animal isn't leaping through the air, and so you can take a group of four tracks, and then you know that you have all four feet on the ground. And there's only so far that an animal can stretch out a leg in front or behind it. And so you have a general idea of what the length of the animal is if you kind of try to air sculpt it or imagine how big it would be with that foot size and that length between those four tracks.
And the other thing that we were curious about, I mean, what people often ask is like, what is the difference between a cat and a dog track? So just, I don't know if we'll be so fortunate as to find a cat track in this area. I mean, I bet you money that bobcats and cougars are traipsing about this area. But in case we don't see a cat track, what are the two differences to look for between the canids and the felids?
Great question. So with dog tracks and cat tracks, they both have four toes that register in their tracks, and they both have claws. However, the cats, as you probably are familiar with from your house cat, just just like house cats, wild cats have retractable claws. And they don't like to keep their claws out while they're walking around. And so you usually don't see their claws register in their tracks unless they're slipping or trying to use them for grip in some way. And so that's the main thing that you can look for, is whether claws are present or not. But then if you get into coyote tracks, like we were talking about in the last episode, they can be really subtle, and the coyote tracks don't always register their claws, at least not in an obvious way. And so some of the other things you can look for are the overall shape of the track. And with dogs, it's more of an oval or an egg shape. And then if you look at a cat track, it's more of a circle. So their toes are kind of more splayed out to the side, making the overall track a circle instead of an oval. And the other big difference is the heel pad shape. So if you get a really clear track and you can see that heel pad, in dogs, it's a nice little triangle. And in cats, it has a lot more going on. There's two lumps on the top of the palm pad and three lumps on the bottom. And so I like to think of it as a bubble M shape. And so
that's a good way to look at it. Yeah, think of it.
So if you look for all of those clues and piece them together, usually you can figure out if it's a cat or a dog track. And then always look at context. I like to try to remember to zoom out and not get so into the one single track you're looking at, but think about what habitat are you in and why would that animal be there? What's the likelihood that it would be there? And just take in all the clues you can possibly find.
And like the difference between the scat with a cat, we always think of them as like marking more. I mean, kind of covering over the scat lightly. Is that generally true, do you think?
Well, with house cats, it's definitely true. With our wild cats locally, we have bobcat and cougar, like you mentioned, and they both have kind of their own particular habits. Bobcats will do a scrape, and cougars will too, where they kind of habitually...
We're seeing galloping otter right now. We were hoping we would see them down here, and sure enough, they're galloping towards us.
Oh, that's so cool. I think it just galloped underneath the bridge. I was wondering if we would see one today because we saw so many tracks already. It seems like we had a pretty good chance. That's cool.
They're probably really miffed that there are people in their little highway here.
Yeah, I wonder. This is such a beautiful spot. There's great blue herons flying over, and now there's galloping otter.
That's right. Oh, no. Now we're hearing a great blue heron coming in and landing. So we're lucky. So we were talking about otter and cat tracks. Oh, scat. And whether cats generally kick soil over their scat or not.
Yeah, so cougars and bobcats will both do this really particular scent marking behavior where they take their two hind feet and they scrape in a perfect line, one foot next to the other, just a short, maybe 1 or 2 foot segment. And they do that over and over again, kind of almost in a trance. And so for the sign that you find on the ground, it just looks like two lines that are parallel next to each other with a little pile at the end. And sometimes there is a scat or urine on it, but oftentimes there isn't anything other than that. With bobcats, usually right in the middle of a trail or an intersection, I think they use it as a way of communication. And so you'll find it in places where they frequently travel, in kind of a prominent spot where it'll be noticed. And then sometimes you'll find latrines. And what I mean by that is that the bobcat will go back to the same location over and over again and keep scatting there, so that maybe even for years you'll find just piles of different ages of scat. And then cougars seem a little more secretive. I don't know if they don't scat as often because they're eating big meals less frequently or if it's just that they travel such vast distances, but you don't find their scat super often. I know my friends who are cougar biologists say they find quite a bit of scat near kill sites where they've been doing a lot of feeding. And they'll also leave scent mounds that are just kind of a pile of usually duffy pine needle sort of debris that is under a dry conifer tree area. And so they're pretty inconspicuous, the cougar sign, from my experience anyway.
And weren't you telling us last time we were out with you that the bobcat scat tends to be really dense? It's way more dense than what a coyote scat would be. That it's because they're mostly eating meat and it turns kind of a greenish gray color. Is that right?
Yeah. So cats are true carnivores. So they're not eating any plant material or very rarely. And they tend to be pretty picky about what they eat and they'll go for the nice juicy organ material if they can. And probably their digestive tract is quite a bit different from dogs as well. So how that presents in the scat is that you'll get these segmented chunks with blunt ends. And it's pretty dense and inside is pretty well digested. And if it's dry, it'll even be sort of powdery. There isn't a lot of like fragments of material in there unless you find bones and that type of thing. And then with the dogs, wild dogs like coyotes and foxes, if they eat more meaty material, you'll get a lot of fur and bones and it'll be sort of a twisty, ropey look with tapered ends. And then if they eat more like berries or plant material, it'll either be that twisty look or it'll sometimes be a lot more amorphous and just kind of a loose pile of stuff. So
and at this time of year we're seeing a lot of scat that has berries in it, right?
Yeah, it's a great time of year for berries, so the scat can be a lot more variation that you see with that type of thing.
Oh, cool. Well, let us meander on and see what else we can find. Oh, and we've just had a yellowlegs visitor. Yellowlegs is a large shorebird. I don't know if it's a lesser or a greater yellowlegs. It looks like a greater, but it's hard to tell sometimes if you don't get them side to side. But it's come and it's wandering about, bobbing and feeding here. And we're also seeing some feathers of great blue herons scattered about.
So we were just watching the yellowlegs and it was feeding and it was doing this really fun action with its beak where it was kind of flicking the mud or the water up into the air. And then we saw it catch a little fish. And so I'm guessing that flicking motion scares the invertebrates or the fish and makes them move around so that it can see them and then catch them and eat them. So that was really fun. It was also walking kind of funny, like its feet were sticking to the mud as it was taking each footstep.
Because the mud here is really sticky. And we also saw it flash a white patch at the base of its tail as it was flying away. So it's cool to get a close view. We don't see those guys very often, so it's a treat. And we've just found our first great blue heron tracks. We knew that we had to come upon them sooner or later, but it's always so startling to see how giant they are. Jill just took a photo and put her hand right down, splayed out, and it's about the same size as your splayed out hand, right?
Yeah, these are really beautiful ones. You can see all the little segments in each toe, and you can see the claws, and the beautiful fingers are about the same length as my fingers. And there's a nice line of them. You can even see them going under the water. I'm always surprised at how tracks will be preserved underwater if the water is still enough. So we've got a nice line of them here.
Remind us another track that we are expecting to find that we haven't found yet are corvid tracks. I mean, either ravens or crows or both. And describe to us how to tell. Aren't the two toes close together on the corvids?
Yeah, exactly. So crows and ravens and jays are all in the corvid family, and they all have similar foot structure. And it's pretty distinctive compared to other birds in that you have the two of the three toes that point forward are paired together. And then you have the one toe going backwards. So kind of like a classic perching bird track, but with the paired toes.
So we've ambled up a little bit farther, and we're seeing what now Jill tells us are more coyote-like. Jill, do you want to describe to us what we're seeing?
Yeah, so we came upon this line of tracks, and they're sets of two, but they're all evenly spaced, and so it looks like either a walk or a trot. And all of the front feet are on the right side, and all of the hind feet are on the left side of the line of tracks, and so that's called a side trot, which is something that coyotes love to do as their primary gait when they're out exploring. So that's a tip right there that we might be looking at a coyote track. And then zooming in on the track itself, these ones are really tight, like all of the toes are tight together. They have the four toes with the triangle heel pad. They're overall oval, so we know it's a canine, and that tight toe configuration points us towards coyote and away from domestic dog. And then the claws are barely registering in most of the tracks, and only the ones that are really deep are showing up. And even those ones, they're much daintier and smaller looking than the big, blunt domestic dog claws that we've been seeing in the other tracks.
And you can see the pad itself is really lodged really clearly, but just little pinprick of nail in front of those. So yeah, that's a really nice example of the difference between coyotes and dogs. We have just found the otter playground. Jill has found it, and they're just cavorting all about this area here.
Yeah, there's hundreds of tracks, I think, in this spot. They were obviously having some fun right here.
And they look fairly fresh.
Yeah, I would guess that happened earlier today.
They probably have a den site someplace close by, I would think.
Yeah, we saw a couple trails going up into the woods earlier that made me wonder if that's their hangout resting spot up there.
So we followed these otter tracks upland a little bit, higher up onto the beach side where it meets the woods. And we found little, what looked like rolling places or resting places, and maybe scat. Do you think that this dark bit over there might be otter scat?
Oh yeah, let's take a look. I think it might be. So we've got a whole bunch of tracks and drag marks, maybe some tail marks in the sand, and then there's some driftwood laying around, and right on top of one of the pieces of driftwood is some scat, and it looks like it has a bunch of scales in it, and I would guess other fish parts. So I would say this is definitely otter scat. It's pretty classic placement too. You've got up under a tree along a water edge, and it's on top of a log. They often like to scat kind of up on top of stuff. So we were just looking at some more scat that we found. So this is a otter latrine area, and it's really goopy and slimy looking, and that's pretty classic of otter scat too. So you'll find like little fish and shell parts, and then they do a lot of scent marking, and they leave a lot of, yeah, fluid slime material that's pretty disgusting.
So we're seeing something else here. We saw these odd deep tracks. At first I was thinking that they were deer, but they looked like they were kind of splayed out. And then we saw there was a kind of pattern with them. So Jill, what do you think we're seeing?
So we saw groups of four, and it looked like a hopping pattern, or you could call it a gallop, but this animal is known more for hopping. And it had pretty small feet when you look at the actual edge of the tracks, but because it's smushed down in the mud so much, it makes it look a lot bigger. And you can hardly see any detail of toes or anything like that, mostly just the pattern. But what you can see is a really distinctive elbow print that goes along with the two hind feet. that are registering in front of the two front feet. And so that tells me that this is a rabbit, and judging by the size and the location, we were thinking it's probably a cottontail rabbit.
And those are non-native here, but snowshoe hares are what we have as the native species, but their foot would be larger, right? And it's probably not the best habitat to find a snowshoe anyway.
Yeah, snowshoe hare, when they splay their toes out, they are meant to be able to float on top of snow. And so their feet are huge when they're splayed out for their body size. And the eastern cottontail are a lot smaller. So when I saw these, I was like, man, they're really big. Maybe they're cottontail. But then, like I said before, when you look at the actual edge of the track and you think about how this animal is splaying its toes out because it's in the slippery mud, if this is the big version of it, then this is a pretty small, it's too small to be a snowshoe hare. But it's also funny that it went in the mud at all. I'm guessing that it jumped in there thinking it was going to be a lot more solid than it was, and then was like, abort, abort.
Well, this is where you can kind of tell the story, too, by seeing kind of this frantic, and we've been a little frantic in places here because the mud is really deep, and you can see the hare or the cottontail thinking, this looks good, and then going, whoa, I'm going to get stuck here.
Yeah, my foot almost got stuck just trying to look at the tracks.
Yeah, that's right. So after seeing those cottontail tracks, we started to think about browse. And I'm surprised that we haven't seen deer tracks here, but probably they're a little bit farther upland from here. And one of the really interesting things that Jill was pointing out last time we were tracking with her is the difference between the browse line between a deer and, say, a hare or a rabbit.
With a deer, they actually only have lower incisors or lower front teeth. They don't have any upper ones. And so when they...
And that holds for the whole cervid family, right?
Yeah.
Elk also.
Yeah, I believe it's all ungulates. And so when they go to tear off some vegetation, it's literally tearing. It's not snipping it with their teeth like a lot of the other animals do. So they use kind of an upward motion of their head, and the cut ends up being pretty rough because they're tearing that vegetation. And then if you compare that to something like a cottontail or a rodent, they will cleanly snip off the vegetation, and it usually ends up being at a 45-degree angle. So it'll look like a little pair of scissors did it, just a really, really clean snip with that 45 degrees.
Uh-huh. And, of course, you also figure in, like, the height of the browse. But if it's something low that's accessible to rodents or hares and rabbits, then you're kind of like, well, was that a deer or was that a rabbit? So it's great to have that little key to look for the pulled vegetation, the rough, scruffy edge instead of the clean scissor cut.
Yeah, exactly.
We just saw the hare tracks, but we didn't find any scat. And what does that scat normally look like, Jill? It depends on what they've been eating, right?
Right. Yeah. So most people can kind of picture rabbit scat in their head from maybe a pet rabbit that you've hung out with. But so you might know that it's little roundish pellets. And that can be confusing because other animals, particularly deer and elk, also have roundish pellets. But there's some really distinctive differences with those. So with the rabbits and hares, I like to think of them as a skittle shape. It's like perfectly round but flattened, usually. It can be different shapes than that, but that's the classic rabbit scat shape. And then the contents are such that you can see visible plant fragments in them. They're small and subtle, but it looks textured, like it has hay or something in there because they've been eating a lot of grass and vegetation. Whereas with the ungulate scat, like deer and elk, they have more of a oval shape that has a divot or a dip on one end, and the other end is sort of pointy or has like a nipple shape to it. And again, that can have some variation, but that's its usual presentation. And there's less visible fragments of vegetation in it. It's a lot more pulverized. And that just must be how their digestive tract works. It's a little more efficient with breaking down that material, maybe because they have multiple stomachs and rabbits don't. And actually, rabbits do this thing where they're known as being caprophagous, because they'll poop and then they will eat their poop and then they'll poop it again. There's that to consider in there too.
Well, the other thing though about change in diet that a lot of people get confused with is with deer. Like in the spring when they're eating a lot of forbs, it can come like little patties. You don't get that pellet shape, or if you look really carefully, you might be able to see some patterning of pellets mushed together, but they end up looking more like cow pies, right?
Right. They can be a lot more amorphous when they're eating things that are really wet, and so that all that wet material passes through them and it ends up being just kind of a plop. But usually if you look really close, you can kind of make out that there's some really not so obvious round pellet-like shapes that are all smushed together to make that patty shape. And so that's often confused for something like bear scat, because you'll see this big chunk and you'll be like, wow, that must be a huge animal. And then you realize, oh, it's just a really weird version of a deer scat.
Well, thank you so much, Jill, once again for taking us out, and to Meg for being our faithful recorder. And thanks to all of you for listening. As always, wishing you happy trails. And our choice for closing music is, Meg and Jill both agreed it's going to be Talk to the Animals.
Yeah, sorry.